Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I am Anna Oberlacher, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Nathan Marcus about his new book, Austrian Reconstruction and the Collapse of Global Finance, 1921 to 1931. Nathan Marcus is an economic and financial historian of modern Europe and currently holds a position as an assistant professor at the Higher School of Economics in St. Petersburg, Russia, where he is right now. Nathan Marcus, welcome to the show.
Hi, Anna. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. And Nathan, I would wonder if you could start the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yes, well, thank you very much for having me. This is exciting for me too. Well, I am a historian who started out being interested in economic history. I grew up in Switzerland and then did a bachelor's degree at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in economics and history, a double major, and then went to do a PhD at New York University, where I got interested in the history of Austria between World War I and World War II. I found that generally the interwar period fascinating, and I knew I wanted to work on that. And after finishing my doctorate, I had two postdoctoral fellowships, one in Florence at the European University Institute, and then I went back to my alma mater in Jerusalem, where I was a postdoctoral fellow actually at the economics department. And then I managed to get a job here in Russia, in St. Petersburg, where I've now been teaching for the last few years while finishing this book that just came out.
Great, thank you. Well, let's talk about this book you just mentioned and your book, Austrian Reconstruction and the Collapse of Global Finance, 1921 to 1931. You study and analyze the events that took place around the hyperinflation in Austria after the World War I and the controversial, let's say, financial aid program by the League of Nations. What got you interested in that subject? How did you come to write this book?
Yeah, well, so when I was a doctoral student at New York University looking for a topic to write my doctoral thesis on, I knew I wanted to do something on the interwar period. And I had a comparative advantage, so to say, because I had a bachelor's degree in economics. So I thought economic history, interwar period, that's a good idea. And because I grew up in Switzerland, I'm fluent in German. So I thought, let's do something about a German-speaking country. And at the time, one of my teachers, Neil Ferguson, was teaching at the New York NYU Business School. And we had a talk. And he suggested looking at this important financial crisis, the banking collapse of Kreditanstalt in Austria in 1931, which I had heard about but didn't know much about. So I went back to the books. I started looking into it. And I realized that this is an understudied event. Everybody mentions it, but nobody really understands what happened. And also realized very quickly that if I wanted to understand this banking crisis in Vienna in 1931, I would have to understand the whole prehistory of the First Republic from the end of World War I throughout the 20s. And so that's how I started. I went to Vienna and started looking at archives with the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And took the history all the way to the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very exciting. That's very exciting. Your book is divided into three main parts: crisis, control, collapse. So the three big C's, I call them. Before I go into details, I would like you to quickly ask about the prologue of the book, which I found very interesting. A prologue titled 1908, so a year way before World War I started and before the events you focus on took place. Nevertheless, it was a rather important year. Can you explain the significance of the year 1901 and how it's connected to the mechanisms we read about in the following parts, crisis, control, and collapse?
Yeah, well, so the idea of writing the prologue was obviously to get the reader, to give the reader the necessary background to understand why this creation of Austria, which today, you know, is considered, Austria is considered a state like any other. At the time, after World War I, was considered so shocking for the Austrians themselves. And so 1908 is 10 years before 1918, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire has collapsed and this new state has been created. And I wanted to use this decade to show how quickly things changed for people living in Vienna, in particular, and in Austria in general. In 1908 is the celebration of Emperor Franz Josef's reign. He has been emperor for is it 70 years, right? For a long time, and they have this huge festive procession through the city of Vienna where they celebrate not only his reign but the history of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And in my prologue, I base myself on other historians to show how at that time already the situation in Austria politically was critical, and people could see how the empire is falling apart along nationalist lines, linguistic lines. But at the same time, how economically the Austro-Hungarian Empire was actually doing quite well, was coming closer together, was experiencing economic growth that led prosperity in Austro-Hungary starting to reach levels of Western Europe, which until then were always more affluent and had industrialized earlier. And so the idea of the prologue was, first of all, to give the reader the necessary knowledge about the prehistory, about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, both politically and economically, and also to show in these few pages how within 10 years this empire shockingly collapsed very quickly, creating a situation that was new, that was full of uncertainties. That had not been expected, that maybe had been unwanted by the people that are the protagonists of my book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think it draws you in very, very smoothly into the subject, which is great, and makes the following chapters even more exciting because you know what it is based on and you realize what kind of shock that must have been for the society. So let's go right into the crisis in 1921, the first big chapter of your book. What were the mechanisms, the circumstances, the parameters under which Austria suffered not only an inflation, but a hyperinflation in the years of 1921, 1922, so after the First World War? And what did that mean for the Austrian society?
Mm-hmm. Well, so what I found interesting when I looked at the history of interwar Austria was how much it resembled events that happened in Germany, the larger loser, the big loser of World War One. It resembled what happened in Germany, but preceded it. So we all know about the German hyperinflation, and historians have debated how much it was intentional. Can't pay, won't pay. We will destroy it. We rather destroy our own monetary system in Germany than pay reparations to the French. But in fact, in Austria, hyperinflation happened before, and there was nothing intentional about it. So whereas the Germans, had seen what happened in Austria before, the Austrians were caught unprepared by hyperinflation. And it's interesting because also by studying this period in Austria, I realized how uncontrollable hyperinflations are. And living here in Russia right now, where the currency has been very volatile over the last couple of years, you realize how financial markets are unpredictable. So you know that there's a risk, hyperinflation might break out, but when it actually happens, how it happens is very difficult to predict and therefore difficult to control. And so in Austria, there were two hyperinflationary waves, one in 1921 and one in 1922. And each time the trigger was a mixture of political news, disappointment about disappointed hopes about foreign aid and foreign intervention, possible loans, and then the public reaction to it, which is panic. Without that, it wouldn't happen. Without people running to the exchanges or running to the shops and trying to spend their money quickly, hyperinflation wouldn't occur. So it's definitely a mix of psychology and politics and finance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you also connect this subject of the hyperinflation with events that occurred in the media and in cultural in culture. So how difficult was it to concentrate on the subject, but at the same time to build up a bigger picture of the subject?
Yeah, so what I found interesting was to look at how ordinary people reacted to hyperinflation, because after all, as I said, hyperinflation cannot happen if the people don't react to it. So there could be, you know, a strong drop in the exchange rate. But if people, you know, brush it off and say things will turn back again to normal in a week or two, I'm not too worried, nothing happens. People really need to panic and say, oh, look, the currency just dropped by 10%, 15%. Who knows what will happen tomorrow? We should better go and buy dollars or pound sterling. And so for me, it was important to try and figure out what did people feel and think and experience during hyperinflation, not just looking at the financial data or at the bankers who are trying to find a way and politicians who are trying to find a way to stop this, but also to tease out what, in one way or another, what I call the fears and hopes, right, of Viennese. And I did so by looking both at financial data, at statistics, and where I argue that there is people really have a distorted sense of time during those hyperinflationary waves, that things speed up around them, and that there's a vicious circle between this experience of time, which speeds up and creates a panic and sustains a panic. So I used statistics for that, showing, you know, that there's the tobacco consumption increases, people move quicker through town by using public transport more often. But I also looked at caricatures, which are meant to be funny. At least they were for the readers at the time, and these are caricatures that are directed at a male audience, a middle class male audience, and they show how during these years of hyperinflation, 1921-1922, male readers of this newspaper experienced uncertainty, feelings of uncertainty, fears about the future, a dystopian view of the future in which their value as Austrian men was being undermined by the influx of foreign ideas, but also foreign money, foreign people, foreign men with hard currency, so to say, with dollars and pounds. And so there's on the one hand this speeding up of time for everybody, and at least in the case of bourgeois middle class men, there's also this fear of the world around them changing fast and making them less valuable, less feeling less at home, feeling less comfortable with the new world that they're finding themselves in.
Mm-hmm. So, and in that situation that was created, the League of Nations steps in to help. First of all. And that was difficult and produced some conflicts as well. How did that process go? And what did the reconstruction program imply? What were the tasks or the duties of the committee that was installed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a big discrepancy between the way the League of Nations has been portrayed in by Austrian historians and the way I have portrayed it in my book based on my research in the archives, both in Vienna and Geneva. At the time, the league arrives in Vienna in 1922 and stays till 1926. At the time, especially the socialist press, the socialist parties, but not only, they attack the league as a foreign intervention that has come to subjugate the Austrian economy, take advantage of its weaknesses, serving the interests of international capital, of international bankers, and therefore. The sooner the league leaves, the better. And you find this kind of negative assessment of the league's intervention also in Austrian history books. This is not a very nuanced picture. And though it's reflected in those original newspaper press coverages, let's say in the socialist press, I find that the reality was quite different. And in fact, the League of Nations served as a cover on the one hand, so it allowed the Austrian government to blame the League of Nations for all sorts of unpopular reforms. Fiscal reforms, austerity that the government had to undertake, and which it knew it had to undertake. It would be wrong to say that the League of Nations is forcing the Austrian government to do things they don't want. No, the Austrian government knows they need to undertake, they need to do those steps. And at the same time, the League of Nations also provides what I call in the book credibility mechanisms. So. Even though the Austrian government has now committed to undertake certain reforms and pursue a monetary and fiscal policy that will not lead to renewed inflation, hyperinflation, how do citizens really know that this is going to be the case, right? I mean, what prevents the citizens, again, from turning back into panic and feeling that things might turn out catastrophic? So the League provides a credibility mechanism by saying, no, we are here to watch and make sure that the Austrian government and the Austrian finance minister and the Austrian National Bank doesn't make any mistakes. This is in both the credibility mechanism and this kind of scapegoat role of the League of Nations are some sort of propaganda. It's not really true, right? So just as it is not true that the League of Nations forces the Austrian government to implement those reforms when if it doesn't want to, in the same way it's also not true that the Austrian government that the League of Nations is really guaranteeing that the Austrian government will make no mistakes. The League of Nations, in the end, in Vienna, doesn't have much power. It's representative a Dutchman called Zimmermann. Who lives there for almost 4 years is largely ignored by the government. He's ridiculed in the press, and he leaves very unhappily back to Rotterdam. Or maybe not unhappy, but at least relieved after a very stressful period in Vienna, in which he was not very much loved, neither by the politicians nor by the press, nor by the people. Mm.
And you talk about that more extensively in your second chapter of the book, control. So control is a problematic issue in a way I understood it. So it's on the one hand it is perceived as weakening of the sovereignty of the state, right? But on the other hand, from another perspective, it is it means that it's things are taking good care of in times of vast uncertainty. So would you say that there is a gap between how the help was intended and how it was perceived?
Yes. Yeah, so I think what makes my book interesting to readers, not just people interested in the interwar period or interested in Austria, is that it's a case study of foreign intervention by an international organization to support an ailing economy. And this is something that has been repeated over the years. And most recently, we've seen this in Greece, right, where the so-called Troika has helped Greece stay within the Eurozone. So in the case of Austria, we actually have the ability to study, you know, archival sources and see what are those decision makers, politicians, bankers, central bankers really thinking and doing? What are the real interests and how does this work? And it's popular to think about, you know, the IMF or the World Bank going to a country in South America or Africa as this, you know, stooges of international capital who come and implement policies that are in the interest possibly of Wall Street, but not in the interest of the local population. And in the case of Austria, you can find these views expressed explicitly in the press, and in some cases also in you know, diaries or people's memoirs, and certainly in history book. But my research tries to show that the situation that the history of foreign intervention in Austria, at least under the League of Nations, is more nuanced and more complex, and that what is called control is wrongly understood as, you know, complete foreign control of Austrian sovereignty by this foreign institution that now runs the show. No, it's much more. First of all, the idea is to impress on the Austrians and foreign investors that there is somebody in Austria now that is overseeing or advising the government in its decisions, but the actual control of the League of Nations and its representative in Vienna is over the money that has been lent by foreign investors, people who have bought this Austrian League of Nations bond and lent this new weak state quite a substantial amount of money. And the second part of control is the revenues, tax revenues and customs revenues, which the Austrian state has pledged, has reserved, has earmarked to service this loan. And so this Dutchman, Timmermans, who is sitting in Vienna, has control only over those two bags of money, the loan money that has already arrived and the revenue streams from taxes and from customs and tobacco that are coming in monthly and that he needs to release to pay to service that loan. So that kind of control is very limited. He can then advise the government and he can demand from the government to do all kind of fiscal reforms, and he does so. He writes reports about the progress of the Austrian government in its economic reforms. But he doesn't really control neither the government's budget nor its decisions. And that's also why, in fact, he remains very weak and vulnerable to attacks and quite.
Mm-hmm. And what were in the end the reasons for ending the program? You said that the League of Nations was there for advice until 1926. Is that correct? Okay. And,
so the whole program was supposed to last only for 2 years. I mean, we as I said, it's a case study not only of a foreign intervention, but of the first foreign intervention by this international multilateral organization, the League of Nations. You have this kind of debt control in other cases when, you know, the Ottoman Empire goes bankrupt and needs more money, then its creditors, France or Germany, France and England, they will create they create those international bodies manned by bankers who then make sure Ottoman Empire repays old loans and new loans. But here it's different because we really have we have an organization which is meant to respect national sovereignty, right? The League of Nations is built on this idea that it's a League of Nations. And even though its financial committee that deals with the Austrian reconstruction is manned by bankers, they are there as, you know, independent experts who are supposed to give advice that is in the interest of the Austrian state and the Austrian people. And so this whole program is meant to go relatively quickly and end very soon and release Austria back into complete independence within just 2 years. But what happens is that following the Austrian and the German hyperinflation, people in 1923 financiers, people with money in 1923 start speculating against the French franc, believing that also France, which is running a government deficit, will experience hyperinflation very soon. And instead, the French managed to get a big loan through the Americans from J.P. Morgan, and managed to stabilize the franc unexpectedly. And this leads to enormous losses among speculators all across Europe, and also in Vienna, where after people had lost so much money during their own hyperinflation, they were possibly hoping to make a fortune now betting on the French hyperinflation. But as that doesn't materialize, They lose money. The stock exchange, the Vienna Stock Exchange, which had grown, which had tripled over the previous months, crashes, dropped, and Austrian banks and investors lose their money. Banks have to close down, and so suddenly there is a new crisis. Just 2 years after Austrian hyperinflation, Vienna again suffers from a fiscal and financial crisis. Banks are closing. The government might be running a deficit again, a budget deficit again, which is exactly what the League of Nations was hoping to prevent. And so they decide to stay longer. They don't release Austria just after 2 years and end up staying until 1926. And now it's not that in 1926, suddenly the financial committee, those bankers in Geneva who are in charge of the League intervention, decide that Austria is now healthy and stable and financially secure. No, what actually happens is that the League intervention in Austria has become so unpopular among the Austrians that there's an increased feeling that to gain real independence and sovereignty, they have to. That's not the right way to put it. That to be really free, to really be free, the best thing would be to join Germany. And there has been a long tradition of pan-Germanism in Austria. It's one of those nationalist movements that under the Austro-Hungarian Empire caused so many problems. German-speaking Austrians who think that their future lies within a larger German nation. And so the French and Italians particularly are very much opposed to Austria joining Germany. And they fear that if the League stays in Austria too much longer, this movement will gain momentum and strength. And so to prevent that from happening and strengthening some sort of Austrian nationalism, which is still at the time very fragile and very young, they decide that time has come for the League of Nations to leave Austria. And the League itself obviously also needs a success. It's a young organization. They want to tackle larger problems. They want to get involved in other areas where economic questions beckon, solve global problems of trade. And so for them also, leaving Austria in 1926 can be sold as a success, as a job well done. And so the Austrians, the international arena, sorry, the Italians and the French in particular, and the League, all of them want to close shop and finish this project. And so, so the League leaves in 1926. Even though some of the financial experts on the committee itself are opposed to ending the program prematurely, and think it would be better to stay there a little bit longer to provide exactly this credibility mechanism, right, and also the scapegoat that is necessary for the Austrian government to continue policies of austerity and fiscal stabilization.
Mm. Yeah, so the title of the last main chapter of your book is Collapse. As we can assume from that title, things didn't go well after the retreat of the League of Nations. Can you explain what happened next?
Yeah, so one of the things I found intriguing studying the League of Nations intervention in Austria was that whereas it's meant as an economic program, right? It's meant to sustain government efforts for cutting the budget, you know, reforming the administration, creating savings, all in order to balance the budget permanently. It had a very strong political impact. Partly, you might argue that it was intentional. The League of Nations is an anti-socialist, certainly anti-Marxist, anti-communist body. And you could say that there was a socialist, very strong socialist movement in Austria. The Socialist Party governs the capital of Vienna and constantly threatens to take over power by democratic means. And if the conservatives ended up, you know, establishing sort of a dictatorship, then the workers would rise up and fight that. So the League of Nations, because it is run by members of the upper class who feel that the working class have gained a lot in wages and benefits after World War One, that the League of Nations sympathizes and sides with the conservatives against the interests of labor and the working class. But the program itself was meant to do so, through fiscal policy, through cutting the budget, through reforms, the firing, of thousands of state workers. But what I discovered is that because of its role as a scapegoat, the League of Nations had a much stronger political impact, creating a political peace. So for the socialists, it was much more easy to attack the General Commissioner Zimmermann during his years in Vienna and attacking the League of Nations instead of attacking the government opposition. And the same was true. I mean, instead of attacking the government in power, the conservatives, and the same was true for the conservatives who were able to pursue policies that were somewhat unpopular, that were costly, that were painful in terms of wages or employment, but then blame the League of Nations. And so those two major political fractions, the socialists and the conservatives, were somewhat kept apart by the presence of the League of Nations. But once the League of Nations in 1926 leaves Austria, very quickly both of those groups, which have armed those political camps, which have armed groups, start clashing publicly in the streets. In demonstrations, which in many cases lead to bloodshed and death and violent death, and so it's you could speculate what would have happened had the League not left Austria. Maybe indeed there would have been those calls for unification with Germany, and things would have taken a completely different turn. But I do argue that. The exit of the League of Nations in 1926 had a politically destabilizing.
Yeah, the collapse you describe in your third chapter. You write about the collapse of the crisis of the Kreditanstalt. What happened there?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, I mean, the Kreditanstalt crisis was what got me into this topic in the first place. And interestingly enough, when you look at the histories of the Great Depression, both in America and in Europe, you hear a lot about the financial crisis of 1931 and the banking crisis of the 1930s, which was both on both sides of the Atlantic, and. In all of the history books that I consulted, the story that is the narrative is that in May 1931, this Austrian bank, Kreditanstalt, which is the largest bank in Austria and the largest bank in Central Europe, closes its stores or collapses or announces enormous losses. And that this triggers like a snowballing effect of banking collapses and financial crisis that spreads, you know, from Vienna to Central Europe. In Germany, you then have the Danat collapse and the German financial crisis of July 31. And finally, in September, in August and September, you have the most important event, speculative attack on pound sterling, the reserve currency at the time, and the Bank of England's decision in the end to exit the gold standard, which is shocking. You know, the bank had done so only in times of war, and now suddenly in times of peace to stop gold convertibility of the British pound signaled this catastrophic turn of events, and there is a real collapse of global finance. So banks stop lending to each other, interest rates go up, interbanking loans go up, and banks start collapsing one after the other. More so in the US maybe than in Europe. And so this was what intrigued me in the first place. But how is it possible that this Viennese bank, no matter how big it might have been, you know, single-handedly causes the collapse of global finance? And if you read the book, you will see that I don't think it actually did. And I go through pains really to try and. It's difficult to prove that something didn't happen, right? It's already difficult enough to prove that something happened. To show that something didn't happen is actually quite challenging. It's just, I find it very important because to show that this Vienna Bank was not a trigger and that there was no snowballing effect and that this banking and financial crisis of 1931 didn't spread like an avalanche, right, out of Vienna. Because even though historians like this narrative and it might make intuitive sense, it is wrong, and financial crises, banking crises, are much more complex, and they have multiple causes that come together at the same time and reinforce each other, and create vicious circles. And such simplistic accounts are not helpful if you want to understand financial crises of today or in the past.
Is there anything we can learn from taking a look at the events from that time for today's events or in connection to the Euro crisis? You mentioned Greece earlier, the Troika, and of course the big financial global financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah, I think there's lots to learn from the past for today, and also I hope that my book does provide some insight not only about the past but also about the present day concerns. As I said, it's in many ways a case study of foreign financial intervention, and so I do think, you know, even though we can't draw one to one parallels, we do learn a lot about what happened in Austria. That can be useful if you want to understand these sorts of financial interventions today. And presenting the league intervention in Austria in a more nuanced form, showing how it was helpful also in providing political stability, and particularly, I think this scapegoating, the way politicians used populism. To create support among their party base by accusing the League of representing foreign interests, of representing interests of international capital, or you might even go as far as saying, you know, Jewish interests. That's resembles in my eyes a lot of what is going on nowadays in countries, say, like Hungary or Poland, where also economic malaise, complicated international problems are simplified by populist politicians. In Hungary, there are posters of George Soros on every corner, saying, "Don't let him have the last laugh." This very much reminded me of the caricatures of Zimmermann that I look at in my book. So I think that we can learn a lot about the mechanisms that underlie this sort of politics by looking at the Austrian case study. Then I think the second lesson that we can learn, or that's a different way the book speaks to present day concerns, is specifically Austrian. So you might ask yourself, why did it take so long for such a book to come out? I mean, you know, if this banking crisis in 1931 did not trigger the Great Depression, how come people didn't say so before? Or if the League of Nations actually was much weaker than people thought, why hadn't that been written about? And I think that's because Austrian historians have, in one way or another, seen Austria as a victim of the 1920s. And that's somewhat connected to the Austrian victim narrative of Austria under the Nazis from 1938 to 1945, which has been much revised, lately, since the Waldheim affair, and historians in Austria and generally the public opinion in Austria is much more critical about Austria's role during World War II and its implication, its involvement, in the Holocaust. But this victim narrative that had prevailed at least in the years following World War II had some kind of parallel or origin in presenting Austria also as a victim in the 1920s, as a victim of large power politics, of the Paris Peace Treaties, then of the League of Nations, and finally of global finance in the 1930s. And so while the victim narrative of the late 30s and early 40s has been revised, somehow historians were not able to see that this victim narrative was also falsifying Austrian history in the 1920s. And so I think another thing we learn here is how important it is for historians to critically engage those national myths, right, and deconstruct them and figure out what really happened, and not try to make sources fit the existing national narrative, but rather change the national narrative and national understanding of history according to the archival records. And there was a third message I wanted to talk about. So maybe, you know, and then we have the case of Greece, which present day Greece, which I think resembles the case of Austria a lot, where Austria is in the 1920s tries to be member of the is a member of the gold standard system, and foreign countries powerful countries like France and Britain are interested to keep this gold standard system working. And when Austria starts experiencing its crisis, Kriegsanschlag crisis in May 1931, central bankers of Europe's important nations, of Britain, Italy, France, they meet in Basel at this newly founded institution, the Bank for International Settlements, and they try to provide emergency funds to help Austria stay in the gold standard area. And the Austrians are aware that they are the linchpin of the system, that if they collapse, if they exited, then possibly other countries might follow. And that very much resembles the case of Greece during the euro crisis, where France and Germany were very much interested in keeping Greece within the eurozone, and the Greeks and feared that if the Greeks were to leave, that that might induce other countries to also abandon the euro. And in both cases, in the Austrian and the Greek case, we can see how these small countries that are considered weak and economically unstable actually can leverage this position that they have within this larger system and try to negotiate assistance and conditions that are beneficial to them, because they have this systemic power, right? That because of them exiting might lead to much larger problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are very exciting insights, and I find it very exciting the new perspectives you gain with your book, especially when you now mentioned the victim narrative. It helps us to understand that this one better, and also the events that are happening today in today's global finance, which is very complex, obviously, as you pointed out. Would you like to add in anything else that's important to you?
Well, I think one of the things that people should know when considering buying the book is that I really try to bring together different methods. That so that on the one hand it is a very traditional approach that uses lots of archival material from the League of Nations, from Austrian government offices, from central banks, correspondence, but I try to use also cultural sources such as mainly cartoons, caricatures that I try to analyze, and finally financial data. And I believe that as historians, when we approach a topic, we should do so open-mindedly. We should not go there with a preconceived thesis, no matter what they tell you in graduate school. We should not go and look at this with preconceived mind and see, you know, do those sources fit my thesis? No, we should go and let those sources speak for themselves and try and see what kind of story emerges. And the more sources we use, and the more varied these sources are from different places, but also of different kind, the more complex our story can become. And so, you know, if sources are there, we should use them. And financial sources, actually, I think, are very, very useful, not just because they are accessible. You know, they're often printed in newspapers. And therefore they're, you know, available online, which is something you can't say about, you know, the letters of Ambassador X to Foreign Ministry Z. And not only are they accessible, also there is a certain objectivity to them, which is difficult to find when you look at other primary sources, letters, or when you try to interpret a caricature. There's very little debate about what the currency exchange rate was on a certain date in a certain year. It's a given fact, and it's reported several times in different newspapers on the same day. And so I believe bringing together those different varied sources and see how they react with each other is what really allowed me to make those historiographic interventions to really change our view about what happened in Austria in the 1920s. And so I just want to, you know, encourage people who are doing history to use financial data or all sorts of sources whenever they can.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much about these insights. Also, the last point you mentioned, I find very interesting, because I also realized when I was reading the book that you have an affinity for storytelling also in your style of writing. Am I right?
Well, I'm glad to say that the first review of my book, which just came out, Actually, said that the book was written is accessible and actually in some even entertaining.
Yes.
So I think you know, for me that means I passed my review with flying colors. If somebody calls a book with this kind of title accessible and entertaining, then I definitely think I did a good job.
Yes, you did. I can only agree with that. I really enjoyed reading it, and I want to encourage our listeners to give it a try, because it's a very exciting topic and it's also very entertaining to read indeed. Is it important for you, for your writing process, to find this kind of anecdotes, stories? How important is that for your writing process?
Well, yes, certainly I don't want to write, you know, spend years and years of research and then of writing to produce something nobody, you know, enjoys. So when I decided to go and write this book, I had, you know, certain friends and family members in mind who read nonfiction and who I hoped would enjoy reading this book too. So, and I knew that just presenting dry data and facts is not going to engage my readers, and hence bringing in anecdotes, literature, cultural sources like caricatures was very important, not only because I believe that using all available sources is necessary, but also hopefully because it will make more of an engaging and interesting read for non-historians.
Yeah, well, we are excited about your work, Nathan. What's the current or next project you're working on?
Yeah, so I actually started looking into a new project, and I will stay loyal to Austria and Central Europe. I want to study the Austrian and German currency reforms that were undertaken after World War II. So it is again about a period of uncertainty, post-war reconstruction, but this time it's in the context not of the League of Nations, but of the Cold War. And what drew me into this field is that, as you might know, the Austrian currency reform preceded a German currency reform. So the Austrian currency reform happened in late 1947 and the German in the summer of 1948. And what was particularly interesting here is that in the Austrian case, Austria, as you know, is occupied by the four forces. Vienna is divided into four sectors. That in the Austrian case, the Western allies, France, Germany, France, America, and the Brits, and there's Allied Control Council, they agree with the Soviets on issuing a new currency in Austria, the shilling, and how to convert it, and what the conditions should be, and a new currency is issued in all of those, in all the four sectors for the whole country. But in Germany, just a little bit more than half a year later, the four occupying powers can no longer agree. And the Americans and British end up unilaterally issuing the Westmark in their sectors, in their zones. And the Russians and Soviets get very angry and upset and declare that that this is a breach of agreement. All economic policy should be done unanimously. And the Soviets then start a blockade on West Berlin, closing off their sector, and the British and Americans organize what is known to be the largest aerial supply flying goods from their zones into West Berlin to feed the population for a period of months, and so we have this point in time where the Cold War, you could say, you know, where things freeze. So until then, maybe it's unclear whether the Soviets and the West will somehow find ways of agreement. In Vienna, in late 47, they clearly still do, but 8 months later in Germany, they don't anymore. And I would try to figure out what is it about those currency reforms in Austria in 1947 that make those the West and the communists, the Soviets and the Americans mainly, right, part ways 8 months later in Berlin.
Well, that's exciting news. And yeah, dear listeners, make sure you follow the research of Nathan Marcus and to get his new book. We talked about today, Austrian Reconstruction and the Collapse of Global Finance. Nathan, I think we've taken up a lot of your time now. Is there anything you would like to add?
Hopefully everybody who buys the book or gets it from a library or reads it online, I hope you enjoy it.
Yes, me too. And yeah, I've really enjoyed talking to you, Nathan. And yeah, take care. Thank you, dear listeners, to listening to this episode of New Books in German Studies. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I did. And I say goodbye for now.